Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We have a slight change of schedule for this morning. We had planned in the first hour to talk with Andrew Schneider. He's an investigative reporter with the Baltimore Sun. We'll be talking about asbestos. He's written a book on that subject, and we wanted to do an update on pending legislation dealing with asbestos. Unfortunately, he's not feeling well this morning. We will see if we can do that on another day. Instead, we reach into the archives for a program on a rather different subject, conversation that we had not very long ago with writer Fergus Bordwick about a book that he's written that's got a lot of positive attention. It's a history of the Underground Railroad. The title of the book is Bound for Canaan. So do keep in mind as you listen to this first hour of the show, we'll not be taking calls. In this hour of the show, we will explore a chapter in American history that really seems to have captured the imagination of a lot of people. And we'll be talking this morning about the Underground Railroad, that system that emerged before the Civil War to help fugitive slaves. And our guest for the program is Fergus Bordwick. We'll be talking about his newly published book, which is titled Bound for Canaan, The Underground Railroad and the War for the Soul of America. Amistad is the publisher. That's an imprint of HarperCollins. In the book, he notes that, a lot of people have been fascinated by, it has captured the imagination of a lot of people, the Underground Railroad. He writes, its true history, however, and its lasting significance are surprisingly little known. Because the Underground Railroad was secretive and because much of its story has been forgotten or deliberately suppressed, its memory has sheared away into myth and legend like no other piece in our history. He goes on to note, however, that what began as a small, loosely organized effort by a few people to help fugitive slaves evolved by the 1830s into a system that, in his words, became the greatest movement of civil disobedience since the American Revolution, engaging thousands of citizens in the active subversion of federal law. While the numbers of slaves that were aided by the system may be small compared to the number of slaves, it was something that he argues certainly loomed large in the imagination of Southerners in the period before the war, and he argues was a significant contributing cause to the Civil War. Our guest, Fergus Bordwick, has written for The New York Times, Smithsonian, American Heritage, The Atlantic Monthly, The Reader's Digest, also author of two other books, Killing the White Man's Indian and My Mother's Ghost. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Bordwick, hello.
Hello, David. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it. Was there something in particular that got you interested in exploring this in depth and took you all the way to writing a book on this?
Well, there are a couple of things that combined to do that. One was that I grew up in a neighborhood in New York State that adjoined a community that was said to have been founded by fugitive slaves who came north on the Underground Railroad. And their story was part of the warp and woof of my childhood, and they were often cited, these nameless folks were often cited as models of people who'd defied injustice and run for freedom. In addition to that, more recently, back in 1998, I was up in Ontario on the site of a place known as the Dawn Institute, which was founded by a man named Josiah Henson, a fugitive slave who fled from Kentucky in 1831, made his way successfully to Canada, and set up a school and a training center for other fugitives. All fugitives wanted three things when they ran for freedom, which was safety, work, and education. And at any rate, the Dawn Institute in Southern Ontario was one of those places that provided that for people. And I stood there trying to imagine who the people were who had come there in the antebellum period, and not just the vague generality of fugitive slaves, but as individuals, as particular people. Who were they? How had they gotten there? What had they left behind? And whom had they left behind? And who'd helped them get there? And those questions were the ones that generated the book. I should also say that there hadn't been a national history of the Underground Railroad since 1898, believe it or not. Hmm. Many, many books for juveniles, but never a comprehensive history.
Well, one of the things that you note in the book, and I just hinted at it with the few lines that I read, is that it's not an easy story to piece together. We don't know precisely. We just make guesses about how many slaves were helped, about how many people there were that were involved in the system. How difficult is it, this as a story, to research and to get the pieces and actually put some people's names to the story?
Well, certainly it was a challenge. I spent about 5 years working on the book, all told. I think there is a perception that because the Underground Railroad was nominally clandestine, secret, underground, therefore the details are unknowable. That's not accurate. What the Underground was diffuse and highly localized. There was never any president of the Underground Railroad, no board of directors, and there was never any central archive, or for that matter, any real archive at all. But records are indeed plentiful in American localities. There was also quite a bit written or recorded by participants in the Underground back in the 19th century and the decades after the Civil War. Books often which were totally forgotten because, as you said in the introduction, that the true story, the depth of the Underground Railroad, really was kind of aggressively forgotten by Americans, I think because of its racial radicalism. Mm-hmm. Highly integrated. African Americans often led branches of the Underground Railroad, organized it, and participated equally with whites. Whites had no special privilege owing to their color. And those truths about the Underground were really not palatable to Americans in the post-Civil War era, when this country abandoned African Americans generally and embraced segregation and racist institutions. So, in short, there's a lot more material out there than people think there is, but it's in local archives, local libraries, local historical societies, and it's in books, many of which deserve to be brought back into, you know, our national literature, but which have been forgotten.
Hmm. Let me just pick up and underscore a point that you just made that I think for you seems to be an important one when you're talking about the significance of this movement, and mm-hmm. that is that it was something that brought black and white Americans together, and the way that you write about it in the book is that it was the country's first racially integrated civil rights movement.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the most exciting aspects of the Underground Railroad. I say exciting not only because it's true, but because it was something that, as I dug deeper and deeper into the history of the Underground and extended its history backward in time, incidentally, to the 1790s, revealed itself as one of the defining characteristics of the Underground. Part of the Underground Railroad legend, as opposed to the history, certainly cast it in a rather monochromatic fashion as kindly white folks helping terrified and confused black folks on the road to freedom, and that's one that flatters white Americans, but it's not particularly accurate. In some parts of the country, the Underground was primarily African American. In other areas, there were more whites, reflecting the demographics of the given area. But by and large, it was quite integrated. And in some areas, the creators and the leadership were always African American. In Detroit, for example, New York City, the founder of the Underground was a remarkable guy named David Ruggles, a free black. In Detroit, one of the several founders was a very courageous individual, George DeBaptist, who had also led the Underground on the Ohio River in southern Indiana. And one could go on and on. There are many stories of people like this in the book.
Mm-hmm. And just before going too much further, I expect that there are a lot of people who at least have some idea what it is we're talking about. But for anybody who might not, I guess we should make the point that the railroad is a metaphor. We're not talking about something literal, although a lot of terminology from railroad things like conductors and routes and things like that were borrowed to give some kind of structure to give people a way to talk about what it was they were doing. But indeed, the railroad we're talking about is metaphorical.
The underground, as I said, had its roots back in the late 1790s in the city of Philadelphia and more or less expanded outward from there. But the underground's period of greatest growth, which was from the 1830s through the 1850s, was exactly contemporaneous with the spread of iron railroads around the United States, particularly in the North. And the lingo of iron railroads just lent itself perfectly to what the underground had already been doing for decades, as you said, conductors, stations for safe houses, station masters for the people who lived there, trains for farm wagons in which fugitives might be carried, and engines for the teams that pulled the wagons. Now, of course, you know, we always, talking about the subject of the Underground Railroad, want to underscore that qualifier that it's a metaphor. We say the Underground Railroad wasn't really a railroad except when it was. And what I mean by that is that the people of the Underground, like all Americans, always embraced new technology when it was available. Our archetypal image of the Underground is usually of a fugitive making his way through the woods following the North Star, or perhaps carried in a farm wagon by from one station to another. But when steamboats were available, they were used. And when iron railroads were available, they were also used. Harriet Tubman, for example, led her passengers up out of Maryland to Philadelphia, usually by land. But then from Philadelphia, she took the train to New York, and in New York City, she bought them tickets at Grand Central Station for Albany, New York. Mm-hmm. So, indeed, in the state of Illinois and in Indiana, railroads were used when they were available. And there were some places where railroad officials who were abolitionists actively, systematically collaborated by providing tickets for fugitives.
I should introduce again our guest, and we have a caller we'll bring into the conversation. We're talking this morning with Fergus Bordwick. He's the author of a recently published book that looks at the history of the Underground Railroad. The book is titled Bound for Canaan, and it's published by Amistad. He also, by the way, has a website that has some interesting material on it about the book and about the Underground Railroad, and that's easy to get to. It's basically his name, www.fergusbordwick.com. His name's last name spelled Bordewich. And so you can look at that if you have internet access. And, of course, you're interested in looking at the book. You can head out to your favorite bookstore. And if you'd like to be involved in the conversation, you can call us. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to talk with in Aurora, and that would be on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good mm-hmm. morning again. Mm-hmm. I just returned from Des Moines, Iowa, from Drake University, from a graduation. And on the way back, we stopped at a rest stop on Route 80. I'm sorry that I don't know the town it's near, but the rest stop building has quilt patterns on the front of it. They're squares about, I would say, 2 feet by 2 feet of quilt patterns. And when you approach the building, it has a plaque that describes the quilt patterns. And then when you go inside, the quilt patterns are on the floor of the foyer. There are about 8 quilt patterns, quite large blocks. And then you go into the main part of the building, and on the floor is a gray terrazzo floor with black showing the different farmhouses that were available and were the Underground Railroad to free the slaves. And I wish I could remember names of the farmers but I can't. There were about 10 farms in that area that the people could go to escape. Are you familiar with that at all?
Well, I'm not sure precisely where that might be, a station on the Underground Railroad often was really a community, and typically there wasn't just one individual in a town who might be...
No, these were all about 10,
yeah.
And they had
yeah.
the name of the farmer. I assumed yeah. it was the name of a farmer.
That sounds very, very plausible, although I don't know the particular place you're referring to.
About 2 hours out of Aurora, going west of Aurora, on Route 80. I wish I knew the name of the town. I didn't.
Well, quite a few southern Iowa communities were founded by people coming out of New England, either by first or second generation. And, I mean, the most famous underground operation that transited through Iowa was when John Brown, just before his Harper's Ferry raid, led a group of fugitives all the way, ultimately from western Missouri through Kansas, through a corner of Nebraska, across southern Iowa, finally up through Chicago and on to Detroit. And it was intended to demonstrate how fugitives could be carried safely over a vast distance, which was his ultimate hope in the Harper's Ferry raid. I mean, that doesn't speak to the community that you were visiting, but certainly there was underground activity in southern Iowa.
It was a wonderful way to visibly show 13-year-old grandchildren a part of history that's very important in America.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of putting a map on the floor of a rest area sounds terrific to me.
Yes, it was.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Program.
And it does that does certainly make the point that there were routes of the Underground Railroad that ran through as far west as Iowa, but certainly through Illinois, in Indiana, in Ohio, around Pennsylvania, and particularly from the south, the border states, I guess, particularly north into the free states. And then ultimately the idea was if these former slaves could get to Canada, then they would be safe from slave catchers who would try to reapprehend them and take them again back south.
Well, far fewer people actually went all the way to Canada than we generally think. The great majority of fugitives settled somewhere in the United States. As I said a while back, people were looking fundamentally for three things: safety, work, and an education. And when they found some combination of those, they tended to settle. And the largest numbers really stayed in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in central New York State, which was sort of abolition central. That's to say the Syracuse, Rochester, Buffalo area of New York State. And probably only 20%. Nobody was clocking fugitives in as they crossed the Detroit River into Canada, for example, so we don't have absolute numbers, but I think maybe only 20%, perhaps 30%, actually went on to Canada, and many actually returned to the U.S. because wages were higher.
Hmm.
But you made a point that I would underscore a little earlier, which was that the vast majority of fugitives came from the border states, really from three states, from Kentucky, from Virginia — there was no West Virginia until 1863, and from Maryland. And far fewer ever made it out of states further south than that. And if you were enslaved in, say, central Georgia somewhere, if we could ever attempt to put ourselves in the shoes of an enslaved person, you were 500 miles, perhaps, from the Ohio River, the nearest free state border, and you'd not been permitted to be educated. You had no maps. You might not even know the names of states beyond your own. And you had between you and the nearest free state 500 miles of towns, each of which had a hired force of so-called patrollers, that's to say armed thugs, mm-hmm. whose sole job was to ensure that you didn't go anywhere. So the odds against escaping from the Deep South were extremely high. Yeah. It was very rare to get out.
What's anybody's best guess, and I know that there are a number of numbers offered, for the number of slaves that did successfully escape slavery?
Yeah, estimates generally range from around 70,000 to 100,000 or a little more. The figure that I settled on in the book, and it's only an estimate, is about 100,000 spread across 60 years. That's to say from, about the year 1800 up to the Civil War. And to put that in perspective, there were 4 million slaves in the year 1860. So we're talking about, as you said at the beginning of the show, a very small percentage. I mean, how is it that one can come up with any number at all? Well, because, in fact, abolitionist newspapers frequently published the numbers that had passed through a given city in a given year. And underground vigilance committees, as they were typically called, in some cities regularly published annual reports talking about how many people they had helped. Now, that was partly because they were receiving donations of money, and they wanted to make clear to the donors that they were doing their job. So by extrapolating from numbers from different cities, it is possible to get a sense of the annual flow and to estimate from that what the total number might have been. And I think 100,000 is a bit on the low side. I think over 60 years, it might be a few tens of thousands more than that, but I prefer to err on the conservative side than not. Mm-hmm.
Well, let us talk with some more people who are listening. Then we'll go next to a caller in Pontiac, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I am wondering if you came across any information on the quilt blocks. I'm a quilter, and I know that there really has been no evidence that's been produced that quilters have seen that show quilts were used to direct people on the Underground Railroad. As a matter of fact, many of the quilt blocks shown are not even invented until well after the 1860s. So did you come across any credible information on this?
Your caller is exactly right. There is no documentary evidence of any kind to suggest that quilts were used by people traveling on the Underground Railroad. It's also absolutely accurate, based on what I've read, that the patterns often cited are, in fact, comparatively modern ones. Now, so I think that's in the order of a modern legend. But the only mention of a quilt in any context that I've come across is actually an interesting one. And it does have to do, of all people, with Harriet Tubman. I mean, the one person who is, if anything, the ultimate icon of the Underground Railroad. And this was on Tubman's own escape from Maryland in 1849, when, in fact, she gave a quilt to to a white woman who had helped her, because Harriet Tubman always paid her way. My point is that she was using a quilt. It was the one thing that she had to give to somebody that was of value. I mean, she wasn't using it as a map.
Right.
Harriet Tubman always paid with money, or she paid with a garment. And on one occasion, because she had nothing else, she paid someone who had sheltered her and some of her passengers overnight with her underwear. But quilts as maps, I don't think it happened.
Yes, and it's become, I mean, it's in the schools. It has become as if it's really part of history, and I think there's just been nothing that's come up to prove it, and it's kind of frustrating as a quilter.
You're right. You're right. I mean, the other side of the coin, insofar as there is one, is that, well, there are a lot of people making very beautiful quilts that are inspired by the idea of the Underground Railroad, and although it, I don't think it has anything to do with real history.
No, no. Thank you.
All right. Sure. Well, thank you for the call. We're at about our midpoint here. And again, our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Fergus Bordwick. He's the author of a recently published book that looks at the history of the Underground Railroad. The book is titled Bound for Canaan and is published by Amistad. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to ask you a question, and obviously this is something that a lot of the book is devoted to a discussion of, but maybe you can talk some about it. And the question is, how it is that something that started out as something that isolated groups of people were doing in an informal kind of way managed to get from that to a much more organized kind of system that involved people in a number of states separated by, in some cases, very long distances. I mean, how did the system as it came to be evolve?
Yes, David, that's a great question. And that problem was one of the knottiest ones to unravel, and I spent a great deal of time, great deal of research time, working that out. What were the points of ignition where scattered individuals who feel that they got to do the right thing when a fugitive turns up at their door? What's the point of ignition where those scattered individuals become a system, an organized system? And, well, I'm going to answer it in a couple of different ways. Now, in Philadelphia, as I said, where the underground began in the 1790s, there was a synergy right at the beginning between free African Americans and some enslaved African Americans. And we should remember, by the way, that all our states except Vermont were slave states until really the turn of the 19th century, at least those east of the Appalachians. So there were still enslaved African Americans in Pennsylvania. And the third component were white abolitionists, and the Quakers, of course, were the first organized group out of the gate to call for immediate abolition. And very early on, Quakers, for example, began calling on friends in the suburbs of Philadelphia and communities further afield to provide shelter and work for fugitives coming out of Philadelphia, so that pattern was set fairly early. Often it took, when you get further beyond Philadelphia, say into the trans-Appalachian states of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, which are settled a bit later, you have isolated immigrants, often from New England, Vermonters, Mainers, Massachusetts people, often turn up out there in the Ohio country as being the first nodes, you know, of underground work. But at any rate, these individual acts or people related by their church congregations, for example, in Ohio, in southern Ohio, the Chillicothe Presbytery, a linked group of many Presbyterian anti-slavery churches, served essentially as the original network for the Underground Railroad beginning as early as the 1820s, and that was through congregational relationships. Families who settled in towns not far apart. But the whole system really becomes turbocharged after the early 1830s with the foundation of the American Anti-Slavery Society and the rapid establishment of local anti-slavery societies across all the northern states. People go to county conventions, they go to state conventions, they begin reading the Liberator and other abolitionist newspapers, and they begin meeting each other and very rapidly networking in precisely the way that we talk about networking today. Mm-hmm. And people at opposite ends of states discover who's who and who's going to help. So by the late 1830s, you've got a fairly efficient, though highly localized operation.
One other thing that I think there you touch on a little bit in your answer that I think is an important point to make as well, and something that you deal with in the book, is that when you look at the motivations for the people who were involved in this, that they indeed did see, they were motivated by their religious faith. This really was a religious, more than being a political movement, it really was a religious movement.
Yeah, very much so. And that, again, is one of the most interesting and, I would say, generally not well understood aspects of the Underground Railroad. The Underground grew, as did the larger abolitionist movement, grew directly out of the evangelical Christian revival of the early 19th century. And the vast majority of white activists in the Underground were driven by a spiritual imperative and typically saw their work with fugitives as answer. This was all law-breaking, by the way, which is important to recognize. You know, it took courage to break the law. But they justified that by appealing to a higher law, a spiritual law, that transcended merely human ones. And they saw their work with fugitives as a form of prayer in action. They were often profoundly religious about their work. Now, I do make a distinction between white activists and black for this reason, that whites, virtually all of whom had grown up in a nation that took slavery for granted, had to work their way, often theologically, to abolitionism, to the idea that African Americans not only were more or less equal, but that the law had to be broken to end slavery. African Americans really didn't need to go through that process. They'd either been slaves themselves, had family who were slaves, or were threatened with being re-enslaved if they were caught. And they didn't need a very lofty intellectual or theological architecture to be against slavery, which whites typically did. And I think it's also, very interesting that the evangelical movement, although it wasn't all abolitionist, of course, was very much on the leftward end of the political spectrum at the time, and very radical, racially very radical. And, you know, today, more often than not, it appears it finds itself on the rightward end of the political spectrum. But through abolitionism and the Underground Railroad, it made a significant contribution to, really, American modern liberalism.
Well, let's talk with another caller here. We have someone on the line listening in Champaign. We will go there. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Have you visited the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati since it opened?
Yeah, I have.
And how is that, in light of your book and the vast literature developing now in the Underground Railroad, would you recommend one attend that to get a perspective on this social network?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a terrific institution. It's brand new, right out of the packing crate, so to speak, which means that it's going to develop, it's going to increase its collections, it's going to continue to innovate as time goes on. This is just the beginning. But I think it has excellent leadership, and Spencer Crew, who was the director of the National Museum of American History in Washington before he went to the Freedom Center. They've got a beautiful building and some really fine people additionally on staff there. And I thought it was a very rich museum experience. I'm a bit of the old school as far as museums go, which is to say I like to see a lot of old objects. And many contemporary museum goers are drawn by a more, experiential kind of theatrical experience. And so the Freedom Center tries to bridge those things with some they have a surround sound theater on one hand, and they also have some very, very interesting collections.
Okay, one other question if I have time. Yeah. We always have thought about how, you know, they had a bounty on Harriet Tubman's life, and we always fear that if she were caught, or she could be summarily executed perhaps, and that African Americans who were in the network could be re-enslaved. What were the penalties for those white abolitionists who were outlaws, as or lawbreakers, as you referred to them a few minutes ago, did they face any criminal sanctions or punitive sanctions?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it was not the same. Incidentally, there's no documentary proof that bounty was actually put on Harriet Tubman's head. It may well have been, but it hasn't been proven. It was something that was asserted.
Okay.
But it might be so. That's just on the side. African Americans who were involved in the underground and in general in the antebellum period could never count on the protection of the law. Never. There are innumerable documented examples of slave hunters, bounty hunters, riding into African American hamlets, whether it's in Ohio, Indiana, Pennsylvania, shooting the place up, not only recapturing fugitives, but kidnapping free blacks and carrying people back across the line. So the degree of courage it took for black Americans to do underground work was really remarkable. You know, now, as far as whites go, most whites in the underground tended to be established members of their community. Whether they were farmers or small business people, clergymen, other professionals, and they could almost always count on the law to at least speak for them. Now, there were whites who were murdered. Seth Conklin, who was killed, after leading a family to freedom all the way from Alabama up to Indiana, remarkable story, it's in the book. And was recaptured because he wouldn't leave the family. He could have gotten away himself, but he was stuck with the family when they were recaptured. And he himself was murdered on a steamboat in the Ohio River by the master of those slaves. And there are other examples like that. People were arrested, fined astronomical sums of money in the currency of the time. Some people's property, lost their property, in effect. Their lives were ruined. Calvin Fairbank, who was a Methodist minister, originally from upstate New York, but worked out of Ohio and Indiana, served 14 years in jail. It was the longest sentence on record for doing underground work. Mm-hmm. And wasn't actually freed until 1864, and was flogged virtually every day. So there's quite a wide gamut, but white people generally could at least go to the law if they were unjustly accused of illegal activity. They could count on legal representation. But I'll give you an example. Levi Coffin, a Quaker who did underground work for 40 years and figures prominently in my book, wrote in his reminiscences, written after the Civil War. He worked out of Newport, Indiana. It's now Fountain City, Indiana. And he said that, there were a lot of people, there were a lot of pro-slavery people in that area who would like to have stopped me in my work. I was on the board of directors of the local bank, and everybody needed a mortgage.
Okay.
So it kind of tells you that, whites tended to be more established and a little bit safer.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. That's a great question.
Again, let me just quickly introduce our guest, Fergus Bordwick. He's the author of Bound for Canaan. It's a newly published book that looks at the history of the Underground Railroad. It's published by Amistad, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. You can find it in the bookstores now. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As we talked a little bit earlier, most of the slaves that escaped with the assistance of people on the Underground Railroad did come from the border states, and understandably, because it meant that there was the distance to the free states was shorter. Most of the people we're talking about were relatively young men, and that's also understandable because of the difficulty of what it is we're talking about. And if you take a look at the total number of slaves that existed in the South before the Civil War, you might say, while the numbers of people who escaped by Underground Railroad were significant in comparison with the total number of slaves, it was a small number. Having said all that, though, I'm interested in having you talk about how people in the South thought about the Underground Railroad, because clearly, it as I said at the beginning, it loomed large in their imagination, and perhaps greater. It had a greater place in their imagination than it did in reality when you took a look at the numbers that we're talking about.
Southerners, especially by the 1850s, constructed a kind of imaginary Underground Railroad in their own minds and imagined that long tentacles of the Underground reached into every corner of the South. And by certainly the mid-1850s and late 1850s, they were attributing virtually every runaway slave to having been snatched away by the Underground. And, I mean, there were just enough examples of Underground activity in odd places in the South to feed these Southern fantasies. Here and there, there's documentation of fugitives being helped off onto steamboats, rather, at a Mississippi River port. A Connecticut minister was arrested in Vicksburg, Mississippi, helping people onto a steamboat. I think that actually was probably a freelance, action rather than representing a whole line of the Underground Railroad. But it should be said also that the Underground, even though the total number of people it assisted to freedom might have been around 100,000, it delivered tens of thousands of former slaves into northern communities. And for the first time, white Americans in the North often met and heard about slavery from people who had lived it. And this had a transformative, tremendous effect on countless Northerners, because it made not just African-Americans, well, not just slaves, but African-Americans into real people. And white Northerners began to empathize with slaves and recognize the horrors and the pain of slavery in ways that they hadn't before. And in that sense, the Underground Railroad had an impact on Northern public opinion way beyond the simple numbers of people delivered to freedom. But, you know, the Underground Railroad was quite a different thing in the reality in the North and the fantasy in the South.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, again, we're sort of bouncing around here, but I find myself thinking about just what a difficult thing that it would have been for someone who decided that they were going to leave captivity and try to get to a free state. If you're talking about someone who might not have been able to prepare real well for this, might not have enough food or supplies or clothing, certainly didn't have a map, would have to navigate by the stars, would be covering territory that they were completely unfamiliar with because they maybe hadn't been all that far from the place that they had been living. And you add on top of that the fact that they would have to be worried about people trying to apprehend them and to take them into custody. And perhaps they could get to one place where there would be safety, but then the question would be, where do I go from here? Where's the next place going to be? Where's my ultimate destination going to be? How am I going to get there? How am I going to know which way to go? It seems a pretty overwhelming kind of idea.
Well, the sad truth is that most people who fled were recaptured. The vast majority of slaves who fled were captured comparatively quickly, for all the reasons you just suggested there. Those who succeeded in reaching the safe embrace of the Underground Railroad were certainly the minority. And it should be said also that there were fugitives who made it into the free states and really never encountered the Underground. It just didn't, you know, they found someplace secure enough for themselves without ever reaching an underground line. Well, you know, there's no single story. The stories of the Underground and of fugitive slaves are as diverse as there are people. And there were stories of people who planned for weeks. They saved what money they could get. They hoarded food. They carried extra clothes. They identified the route that they would have to follow, and they were captured in 2 days. And there are others, and quite a few, who ran on impulse. Just one, they snapped one day. They just couldn't take another beating. They you know, a child was, or a parent for that matter, was sold away from them. They just looked at the hoe in the field, so to speak, one day and said, "Not never again. I'm not doing this anymore." And they just ran with nothing. And both types of stories you'll find in my book, Bound for Canaan. And many of those people who ran on impulse succeeded because there was a great element of chance. Now, the point of, I mean, one of the greatest points of danger, of course, was actually crossing over into a free state, either at the Pennsylvania state line or the Ohio River, and not knowing what you were going to find on the other side. Many fugitives had a notion that as soon as they reached a free state, they were completely safe. Sad, but sadly not true, since there were always fugitive slave laws on the books which required that fugitives be returned to their masters. That law wasn't, the 1850 law wasn't the first one. There'd been one on the books in 1793. There were always bounty hunters. There were always spies watching for fugitives. Typically, fugitives asked for help from other African Americans. They avoided asking for help from whites unless they were driven to the last extremity. They didn't trust whites. Surprise, surprise, guess why? Because they'd never had any reason to trust white people. But the underground worked as a long-distance network thanks to the synergy between free African Americans and white abolitionists. White abolitionists tended to have long-distance connections. They had money, and the Underground Railroad cost money. It cost money to hire wagons, to hire teams, to buy food, buy clothing. Things were donated, but money was necessary. And whites, as I said earlier in our conversation, also had some protection from the law, even though what they were doing was illegal in more than a few areas. The local authorities either turned a blind eye or were, in fact, friendly to the underground. I know we're going a little far afield from your question, but you know, the experiences that the fugitives had are vastly diverse. You know, and one thing I learned in writing this book is to be wary of generalizing and to try to look at each case in its own way.
We're getting down to the point here. We're almost out of time. And one other thing that I wanted to have you talk at least just a little bit about for a minute or so are connections between the movement for women's suffrage and the abolition movement.
Sure. I mean, not only was the underground the first interracial political movement in American history, not only was it, as you said earlier, the first mass movement of civil disobedience since the American Revolution, but it was also, with the larger abolition movement, the seedbed of the American women's movement. All the women who organized the first women's rights conference at Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848, came out of the underground, every one of them. Abolitionists, women's abolitionist societies began to be founded in the 1830s. Women themselves were encouraged to participate in anti-slavery activity, and in that process, began to discover their own voices, and began also inexorably to see analogies between the enslavement of African Americans and the legal position, the oppression of American women, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the first national leader of the American women's movement, once rather famously said, woman can understand the slave far better than man ever can. Women participated in the underground in very much the same ways as men did. They also were the ones typically who provided the place to sleep, who fixed the food, who provided the clothing. They often were guides on the underground. And they found their voices, as they said, in speaking out against slavery.
Well, I think at that point we're going to have to finish with the recommendation that people look at the book. It's a very rich story. It's titled Bound for Canaan, The Underground Railroad and the War for the Soul of America. It's published by Amistad, which is an imprint of HarperCollins by our guest Fergus Bordewick. And his name, if you go looking for the book, last name spelled B-O-R-D-E-W-I-C-H. And he also does have a website, which is fergusbordewick.com, that has some more information on the book. And if you have access to the internet, you can look at that. Mr. Bordewick, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, David. I've enjoyed the conversation.